Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is a pre-recorded show in which we take a look back on some of our best recent segments. We'll take a look at Michigan tourism and vacationing with an MSU professor. We'll also chat with Edward Blum, author of The Color of Christ, The Son of God, and the Saga of Race in America. But first, time banks have been cropping up across the country as an alternative method of community building. There's one just starting here in Lansing. Very loosely, participants in a time bank trade work hours in a common effort toward community improvement. But there's way more to it than that, and here to give us a much better explanation of what time banks do is Edge Brussel, coordinator of the new time bank here in Lansing. Welcome.
Hello.
And also joining us by phone from Madison, Wisconsin, Stephanie Rierich. She's the co-director of the thriving Dane County Time Bank there. Welcome, Stephanie.
Good morning.
Let's start out with just a good working rudimentary definition of what a time bank is. Stephanie, you want to take that?
Sure. Well, some of the listeners will have heard of a babysitting co-op, and if you have, it's like a babysitting co-op, but for everything. So it's a place where we bank our time. It's a mutual credit network, so we get together and decide to extend credit to each other. And what that means is we list what people have to offer each other, and it can be very simple things from walking a dog or calling someone to check in on them to something like teaching a language or fixing a computer. And every hour I spend helping another member in the time bank, I get an hour in my account, and I can turn around and use that to help another member. I mean, to get help from another member, so I can teach you a piano lesson 1 month, and the next month I can get my computer fixed. And it's very flexible. I can spend hours before I earn them or vice versa. And really the goal is to connect people and match unmet needs with unused resources. So besides really connecting needs, connecting people with what they need, it really connects people with each other who they wouldn't have met otherwise. So it's a great way to build community and then also pool resources, which we'll talk about more later.
How do you get the members, though? How do you start this whole thing?
Well, everybody has something they need, and one thing that a lot of people in this country really need desperately is more of a sense of community. So I've found that it's a pretty easy sell when you start talking with people about it, and you just really need to start by getting a group of people together who are interested in making these kinds of exchanges. And for us, it's spread a lot via word of mouth, and the trick is getting a diverse enough group of people who have really different needs and assets from each other so you can really get the exchanges flowing. And for us, it really made a big difference to really bring people together around common community goals and view our time bank as a way that we pool our resources to be able to work together to meet goals like restorative justice or health and wellness access or energy efficiency, those kinds of things.
Edge, what's it like getting Lansing's time bank started?
You know, people that I've spoken to are very receptive and excited about this getting started. I think everyone that I've spoken to has wanted to become involved, is excited that this is happening. I haven't really had anyone think it's a bad idea for the community. I think it is a pretty easy sell. Neighbors need to get to know their neighbors. We need to transition away from this economy of strangers to an economy of trust.
And everybody needs something, and everybody's got something to give. So, I mean, that makes the exchange really, theoretically at least, it makes it really quite feasible. Stephanie, it sounds like a great idea, but also one that would be difficult to get momentum going. What does it take? You're up and running. You're successful. What does it really take to become successful?
It really just takes energy from the people involved. A time bank is exactly, well, it's greater than the sum of its parts, but the parts need to be active and participating. And that's why I mentioned bringing people together around common goals is extremely helpful. So one of the goals for us was really changing the dynamic of how many kids we're sending to prison or getting into the prison system. So a goal for us was to start a restorative justice youth court program, and it resonates with a lot of people here. A lot of people really want to see something change there, so it's an easier thing to get people involved in. And people are used to volunteering or working in situations where they have structure and they go in and know what they're supposed to do. And it's really helped our time bank to actually put some structure around some of the work that people do in a time bank, partly because that's what people are used to. And also it's more exciting when you're motivated by something that's where you're really doing something in your community that you want to see happen.
So it's practical and it's idealistic at the same time.
Yeah,
really,
absolutely.
In a way. It can be both. Edge, do you have a particular focus like that for Lansing's Time Bank?
Yeah, I mean, part of it is we want the people that join to bring their focus. But right now, the two focuses that we have are food. Right now, Lansing's economy is tied to the national economy. It's tied to the rise and fall. And right now, we want to take that and shift it to being sustainable and being able to create our own food, get more people out growing food, teaching people how to prepare that food and store it for the winter. Our other focus is on collaborating to educate each other, to teach each other and to reskill, to help share what we know with the people around us.
What do you need most right now? Do you just need to get the word out about this thing? How are you approaching growing the Lansing Time Bank?
Yeah. We need people involved on all levels. First of all, I would say if this is an idea that excites you, we would love to come to your neighborhood and go door to door with you and talk to your neighbors and invite them to a community potluck of your neighbors to talk to the individuals that are closest to you about what the needs of your neighborhood are. We need people to just join and be excited about being on the system. We need people on all levels to help us.
Okay. Stephanie, any advice you feel you can offer Edge as she launches Lansing's Time Bank?
I would say keep doing what you're doing, and the things that you're focusing on now are great, and just the ideas that you have about how to connect with people. So that's the main thing. It spreads best through word of mouth and with people understanding that it's really what you make of it. So you can build something really beautiful and exciting when you get the people involved.
A question for both of you. Stephanie, how do you respond to people who say, I love all your goals, but I really don't feel like I've got anything to offer. I've got really anything to give. How do you respond to those comments?
If you're speaking to me right now, you have something to offer. You could call people and check in on them or visit with people. And a lot of the things that are really in demand are very simple things like companionship and recreation and transportation. So everyone has something to offer. I would just have a conversation with the person and find out what they like to do. One thing that is good about the Time Bank is it gives you a chance to do more of what you like and less of what you don't like.
Edge, any response to that? Have you encountered that response yet? I love the idea of making the community a better place. I'm all about food and education, but I really got nothing to share.
I would say the community needs you. I spoke to an elderly woman, and she came up to me and said that same thing. She took my hand and said, this is great, but I don't have anything to offer. Yeah. And I spent 5 minutes talking to her about, the things that she loved to do when she was younger. And she said, I used to keep a garden, but I obviously can't do that anymore. And, we suggested to her, well, what if we got a group of kids to come over and you could teach them how to garden? And her face lit up. Everyone has something to offer, just as Stephanie said.
Stephanie, how important is funding? Can you get the lion's share of your work done with a modest amount of funding, or could you really use cash here?
We could all really use cash, and we tend to operate on shoestrings. And, we are running 4 youth court locations. We have a Time Bank store. We're a partner in Energy Co-op, really building an energy efficiency program. And we have a wellness project. And we do all that with what's, for a lot of Time Banks, a large budget, about $200,000. But when you think about all the activity that's happening, it's a pretty small budget. So we are able to stretch our money pretty far. But at the same time, people who are working on it full-time still need to pay mortgages and pay for the lion's share of their energy and food with in the cash economy. So we do need to pay people with money, and so we're always looking for funding. And so if you're listening to this and you want to donate to the Lansing Time Bank, I encourage you to, because they'll need funding to get started.
But you can get a lot done with partnerships, though, correct?
Yes, tons. Yeah.
Edge, where are you looking at for partnerships?
Yeah. So, first, I just wanted to say, in talking to the other time banks, we've learned that, one of the main reasons why time banks fail is that they start out with a beginner grant, and then that grant doesn't get renewed, or they have one coordinator who is paid, and then that pay goes away, and the time bank sort of collapses. Mm. So we're trying to figure out how to do this with as many community partners, caring about nesting time banking within their model. We're specifically reaching out to people in the food movement, to the gardening network, but really any nonprofit. a partnership between the Time Bank and any nonprofit organization will help and support both. Because if a nonprofit is able to start giving time dollars as an incentive to their volunteers, they will help ward off volunteer burnout, and they'll have people excited about being part of this local currency. So.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, how exactly did you get the juvenile justice system and the school district on board? What were those conversations like? How big a job was that?
It was pretty significant, and as you referred to it, partners and champions. We approached people right off the bat who were involved in that aspect of the system who we thought had common values. So we found our allies in that system and started communicating with them right away, and it was at least a year-long process before we actually started the youth court, and then we started it, and then we had to be up and running on a really small pilot, sort of under the radar scale, and then people noticed the results we were having and picked it up more. So for us, a lot of it's just pulling together who you can and starting something on a small scale, because people have a hard time grasping the possibilities of something brand new to them until they see a little bit of the evidence.
Edge Brussel, we've got some number of listeners who are interested enough in this to place a phone call or visit a website. Where do people go?
Absolutely. So first off, you could like us on Facebook, greaterlansing.com, Greater Lansing Time Bank at Facebook. You can email us at greaterlansingtimebank@gmail.com. You can call us at 517-862-0422.
That was Edge Brussel, coordinator of the new Lansing Time Bank, and Stephanie Rierich, co-director of a thriving Dane County Time Bank in Madison, Wisconsin. Jokes about Jesus' image are everywhere.
I like to picture Jesus in a tuxedo t-shirt because it says, like, I want to be formal, but I'm here to party, too. Because I like to party, so I like my Jesus to party.
I like to picture Jesus as a ninja fighting off evil samurai.
All right, I'll be the one to say it. How do we know you're really Jesus?
I'm mainly here to correct a major error that you people have been basing the faith on.
What's that?
Jesus wasn't white. Jesus was black.
However, underlying this humor are the conflicts of race, which continue to persist in America. Today I'm joined by Edward Blum, a historian of religion and race in America at San Diego State University and co-author of the book, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America, which looks at how the varied configurations and depictions of Jesus tell the history of race in the United States. Welcome to Current State.
Glad to be here.
Let's look to the Bible first. Are there any descriptions of what Christ looked like, reliable descriptions in the text of what Jesus looks like?
Even though there are four biographies, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, no description of hair, skin tone, eye color, no discussion of that at all.
Any other reliable early depictions of Jesus?
No. For the first couple hundred years, the early church, these were people running around in catacombs. They were, you know, busily getting murdered in Colosseums, so they were not creating images. It wasn't until hundreds of years later that they started to even talk about, can we represent what Jesus looked like?
And in colonial America, the image of a white Jesus takes root. Is that correct?
Yeah, it takes root, though, after the Puritans destroyed images of Jesus. Part of the Protestant Reformation was, hey, these Catholics are violating the Second Commandment against graven images. So America's first colonists didn't have white Jesus images. It wasn't until around the time of the American Revolution and a little bit after that.
Well, are you saying then that there was a wider perception of Jesus as being a person of color in the Catholic Church?
At times there were. In the Middle Ages, there's actually a couple hundred black Madonnas and black Jesus figures kind of circulating all over Catholicism. And if we look at South America, we see the emergence of Our Lady of Guadalupe, who was a mestiza Madonna when the Spanish interacted with Native Americans.
So is that there's a pattern here. The dominant race depicts Jesus according to that dominant race. Is that a general pattern we can say?
It sometimes is if you have a theological inclination to do it. So if you actually want to use images to teach children, and you have to have power, right? To create an image, you have to have time, for instance. You know, slaves don't have time to sit there and, what color do I, how do I want to paint Jesus today? You also have to have stuff. You have to have marble. You have to have paper. You have to have paints. So if you don't have those things, you can't produce it. And then finally, reproduce it. Who has the ability to reproduce an image, whether it's on paper or in film? Only certain people have those powers at certain times.
So over time in the United States, a Jesus of color, does a Jesus of color slowly begin to emerge?
Okay, we have three times where Jesus is non-white, three kind of moments, and they're all in the 20th century. The first is during the Harlem Renaissance, when you get African-Americans like W.E.B. Du Bois or Marcus Garvey creating a kind of pro-black culture. Then we get it in the 1950s and the 1960s during the Civil Rights Movement, and we get the rise of black liberation theology from folks like James Cone. And then now more recently, we get black Jesus in our comedic culture. So you can hear Chris Rock, the comedian, talking about, Jesus was black. So those are the three iterations of Jesus as colored throughout the 20th century.
Your book looks at how this image of Jesus has been used as a means for suppression as well as a tool for empowerment. Maybe one of the most interesting cases of this dual role is the image of Jesus during slavery. The depiction of Jesus during slavery is that of a white man, yet it's an image that both master and slave take comfort in. How does that work?
So the master sees Jesus as the suffering servant and then tries to teach slaves, like, hey, it's okay that you're a servant. Look, even God's son was a servant, so that's okay. Slaves take it and they meet a white Jesus and this is a Jesus who comes to redeem them, not to rape them. He's a Jesus who listens to them. There was a slave song that went this way. He owns me and I own him. And to think about that, these are people who don't own anything. They're owned by other people. To think that they own the Savior, they own a white man. So in fact, the white Jesus in that capacity, he acts unlike other white men. And so what it does is it kind of takes away white power, even though Jesus himself is white. He's a friend to them, a good man to them, not a terrible man to them.
So beyond slaveholders, are there other groups that have used this image of Christ, in your view, to justify this supremacy?
The most obvious case is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, who create, and this is the Mormons, who have a white Jesus, and they also have a racial theology where Brigham Young argued that if a white person had sex with a person of African descent, that white person should be beheaded, okay? Not just thrown out of the church, but it was that much of a sin. So for them, having a white Jesus was part of that white bodies were more sacred than other bodies.
What do we know about the LDS today? I mean, how has that attitude gone forward here into the 21st century? Is it extinct? Are there signs of it? What?
Well, in 1978, the church had a new revelation that opened up their priesthood to black men. Before 1978, you couldn't be a full member if you had any African descent. So on one hand, they've changed quite a bit since 1978. But before that, in the 1960s, they took a gigantic white marble Jesus and started putting it in their welcome centers. So if you want to go, join the church, you walk through, here's a big, huge white Jesus to welcome you. So it's kind of like, we give with one hand and take away with another.
Do other countries, is the appropriation of the image of Jesus unique? Is this uniquely American, or this is more widespread?
Well, throughout the world, anyone who's dealing with Jesus at some point deals with a material incarnation.
Right.
What's been so fascinating is how in the 20th century, we've become an exporter of Jesus imagery. So if you go to Africa, you can go to parts of Asia and put up a poster of Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ with Jim Caviezel, the actor, playing Jesus on it, you can find locals actually going up to it and touching it as if it's sacred. because of the power of media. The most viewed movie in world history is a film called Jesus. 1 billion people have seen it. All the actors are played by Middle Easterners except for Jesus, who's played by an Englishman. And the film was made in 1970, and so it's become a kind of image for the world. Not that we can't. We can find Ethiopian Jesuses. We can find Asian Jesuses, but even the dominant one.
Asian Jesus.
Yeah, really? known as the brown-skinned one. But these films still play a role even globally, that we have a global export. Just as Michael Jordan and the Swoosh are exported,
right. The
white Jesus is exported too.
What does the community, there must be a community of historians, reputable historians, who study ethnicity, ethnic movements geographically. Is there any kind of consensus on where Jesus lay amongst members of that community?
How do you mean?
I mean amongst people who study this academically, who study the history of ethnicities in the Middle East 2,000 years ago.
Oh.
Is there any kind of consensus there?
Yeah, so there is a sense that what did Jesus really look like 2,000 years ago? The consensus is brown-skinned, probably short hair, probably short himself, brown eyes, and actually Popular Mechanics put out a Jesus, what he would have looked like. And so it's that definitely not white, definitely not blue-eyed.
That was Edward Blum, historian of religion and race in America at San Diego State University. He's co-author of the book, The Color of Christ, The Son of God and the Saga of Race in America. Years ago, the strongest earthquake ever to strike Japan triggered a massive tsunami. The 9.0 magnitude quake killed nearly 19,000 people and left some 300,000 homeless. The event also damaged the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant, causing the world's worst radiation leak since the Chernobyl accident back in 1986. Now, on Monday, Michigan State University will commemorate the second anniversary of the Great East Japan Earthquake with an event at the campus's International Center. One of the speakers will be Dr. Ethan Siegel, a professor of history here at MSU and an expert on Japan. And Dr. Siegel joins me now in the studio. Nice to have you in here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
How has the recovery process come along here in these 2 years? What's working? What isn't working?
Yeah, it's unfortunately a somewhat mixed situation. It's been slow, and particularly for people in the region. I've had the chance to visit affected communities on 4 different research trips since March of 2011. And there are some very hopeful signs. Many of the port facilities have been reconstructed. And there's a lot of government aid that is going into the region. But there are also a number of significant issues that linger. As you mentioned, about 300,000 people still who cannot return to their homes, problems with unemployment, and of course, in the area around Fukushima, the issue of radiation and contamination is so severe that some communities may never be able to return home.
What about housing?
Housing also is a very serious concern. Most of the people who lost their homes are still living in temporarily erected housing communities. Those were initially supposed to have been in place for 2 years, but it appears they'll have to continue because of problems with rebuilding. It's unclear whether communities can rebuild in their former coastal locations because although some people say this tsunami was a once-in-a-thousand-year event, if it happened again tomorrow, there's no way to prevent it. So whether they can rebuild in those communities, whether higher seawalls will be necessary or even feasible, these kinds of issues still, unfortunately, have not yet been resolved.
What do we know about the after effects of the radiation leak from the nuclear power plant?
Well, it's interesting. There just was a study released earlier this year that suggests, although some smaller, higher, or some slightly raised incidents of thyroid cancer and other kinds of cancers have been detected, the numbers are not as high as they had perhaps anticipated, which I suppose is encouraging. although I think that the data is still very much out on this issue. The studies will have to continue. One study is anticipating 30 years of research following the victims of Fukushima. And another of our colleagues here on campus, Dr. James Trusco, has actually been following this issue very carefully in the College of Human Medicine.
Now, does this interplay with clean water issues? Is clean water being addressed? Is it available?
As far as drinking water goes to the temporary housing communities, as far as I'm aware, that has not been a problem. There has been a very serious problem, however, with the ocean water. Because of water leaked from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, the reason all these nuclear power plants are built along the ocean is they need water for cooling. And the way they had to try to deal with the emergency at Fukushima was by flooding the plant. And some of that water then gets released into the ocean. And it's almost impossible to trace once it's mixed in with the ocean water. So what this means for the fishing industry and many other seaside industries remains unclear.
So how are they contending with that? Do they have a plan for addressing that?
Well, there are a number of plans that are being discussed and debated, but I'm not sure anything that I think is really going to alleviate the situation. There was a study just, or a report rather, just released that TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company that runs the Fukushima plant, is planning to dilute some of this water that it is storing for cooling purposes and then release it into the ocean because it's running out of storage capacity. And many of us, me included, are quite unsure that that's really going to be adequate.
What's happening with regard to the country's approach to nuclear power in general after this?
Yeah, that also, unfortunately, is not entirely clear. The previous two prime ministers, Kan and Noda, who were part of the Democratic Party of Japan, which was in power at the time, expressed interest in moving Japan away from nuclear power. But the most recent elections, which put Prime Minister Abe, the current prime minister in power, from a different political party, he has backed away from that position and believes Japan should continue on moving ahead with nuclear power. There are many in the public who are opposed to this. Earlier, on March 11th, there were over 300 rallies held around the country to express public opposition to this policy. The issue, though, is that Japan is very poor in natural resources, meaning fossil fuels. So back even in the 1950s, the nuclear power industry was very successful in convincing politicians and the public that Japan needed nuclear power. And those issues of a lack of natural resources remain. So although there are many who would like to see Japan move to more renewable resources, wind, solar, and the like, developing that infrastructure would take a lot of time. What they've done in the short term has been to import fossil fuels, which is very expensive, and of course does nothing to help problems with greenhouse gases and the like. So the situation, again, is not entirely clear.
Japan has such a long and curious history with nuclear power, which you just alluded to. There was, of course, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but later the Japanese government, as you say, went all in on nuclear power as an energy source, and it's even become prominently featured in Japanese popular culture to an extent, in anime and manga. Tell us about that.
Well, indeed, as you suggest, the government early on drew very careful distinctions between nuclear weapons, such as that had been used against Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and nuclear power. And they convinced successfully the majority of the public that nuclear power was safe. One of the great post-war animated heroes of, say, the 1950s and 1960s was the character Tetsuan Atomu, who we know in English as Astro Boy, the same character drawn by the great manga artist Osamu Tezuka. And he was a robot boy. The story is somewhat Pinocchio-like, perhaps, but unlike Pinocchio, he is powered by a nuclear heart, a nuclear active, you know, energy heart. And he was a great hero, a great friend to humanity, and one way that people could see nuclear power as a safe and friendly resource. This continues with many more, you know, recent anime and manga images, and I'm told that even school children in some schools are shown animated videos to help convince them that nuclear power is safe. The perhaps more important issue, though, is where many of these power plants are built. These are in communities, oceanside communities, that have few other economic alternatives. If fishing is not successful, then there aren't many resources for these towns. And so they agree to allow power plants to be built because of all the money that the industry brings to their town, both jobs and investments. And so they've taken big risks that I imagine some of those communities now regret.
We've been listening to Dr. Ethan Siegel, professor of history at Michigan State and an expert on Japan. The United States is the premier nuclear power in the world, but the geopolitical landscape has radically transformed since the height of the Cold War. Meanwhile, our stockpile of ballistic missiles, nuclear submarines, and large bombers is aging and in need of expensive upgrades and replacements. So, as America moves forward in the 21st century, what kind of nuclear arsenal makes sense? Here to help us answer that is Steve Pfeiffer. Steve is the former ambassador to Ukraine and director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative at the Washington, D.C. think tank. Welcome, Ambassador Pfeiffer.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Appreciate it. Before we get into the details, can you give us a sense of the scale we're talking about here? I'm sure the exact number is a guarded secret, but about how many nuclear warheads does the U.S. maintain?
Well, actually, it's not a secret. In 2010, the United States released a number and said that as of September 2009, the total American stockpile was 5,113 weapons.
Okay.
Which is a huge decrease from the Cold War. At the height of the Cold War, there were 25 or 30,000 weapons. But you still have to ask the question, does that number make sense 20 years after the end of the Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union?
What about the dollar cost of maintaining that arsenal?
The dollar cost in terms of maintaining them on a day-to-day status is estimated at, say, $30 to $40 billion a year. So it's a part of the defense budget.
Wow.
But where the costs get really big is if you look, say, 5 or 7 years down the road, where the Navy's going to have to start building a new ballistic missile submarine to replace the Ohio-class submarines, which have to be retired in about 15 years. And then you're talking about an estimate of $6 to $7 billion per boat, not counting the missiles or the torpedoes.
So upgrades are hugely expensive.
Well, or replacements. I mean, a submarine can basically operate for about 35 years, but then it just gets to the point where you've got to retire it. So you have to build a new submarine.
Okay.
And they're trying to find a way to cut that cost, but shipbuilding prices usually go up.
Are we still producing more nuclear weapons, or has production of new nuclear weapons stopped?
Well, when you talk about the nuclear weapons per se, actually, we don't produce new nuclear weapons now. What the policy is, we extend the life of existing weapons. So they'll do what's called a life extension program, where they'll take an existing weapon and they'll go and replace those parts that have basically reached their shelf life, but basically keep the same weapon intact. And one of the things that we've learned in the last 10 years is that nuclear weapons in the American stockpile actually have a much longer longevity than had been anticipated, say, 25 years ago.
Okay. But again, we're getting back to the number. We're talking a little north of 5,000.
That's probably come down to maybe in the last 4 or 5 years. The guess is it's probably come down to more like around 4,600, 4,700.
Okay. Okay.
So it's moving down.
The other key player here is Russia. It's Russia and the United States. Even after a new START treaty is implemented, Russia will still have at least 2,000 nuclear weapons, from what I'm told, and plus an untold number of non-strategic weapons, likely numbering in the thousands as well. What is Russia's place in this discussion?
Yeah, the guess is that Russia has about 5,000 to 1,000 total nuclear weapons, so roughly the same as the United States. And this is one of the issues about the new START treaty, which President Obama and then President Medvedev signed in 2010, is that treaty, which is a good step, it limits each side to about 1,550 deployed strategic warheads, but it only covers those strategic warheads that are deployed. It doesn't address reserve weapons or tactical weapons. So it covers only about 30% of the U.S. arsenal, and maybe it's time for the United States and Russia to begin talking about limits on all of their weapons.
And I misspoke a minute ago. I guess the new START treaty has been implemented already. Okay. All right. Just last Friday, the United States decided to restructure its European missile defense approach. How does this alter the situation involving Russia?
Well, it remains to be seen, but for the last couple of years, Russians have been not enthusiastic about reductions going beyond those that they've already agreed to in the new START treaty, which is now being implemented. I think the Obama administration would like to reduce further. One of the reasons the Russians have said they did not want to reduce is because of concern about the American missile defense plans for Europe. And phase four, the last phase, which is the one of most concern to Russia, was canceled last week by the Defense Department. So hopefully that removes an obstacle that then might allow a resolution of differences on missile defense, which then could remove an obstacle to further negotiations. Now, the initial word out of Moscow is not encouraging, but the Russians often react very slowly to ideas. As one of my colleagues once said, the Russians say no, no, no until they say yes. So hopefully we haven't heard the final word.
How have our allies in Eastern Europe responded to what we've just announced, or what you just referred to?
I think the first three phases were primarily aimed at defending Europe. So in phase two, there would be a missile interceptors in Romania. In phase three, there'd be interceptors in Poland. Now, those will go ahead, and those interceptors will have the ability to protect Europe. Phase four was going to be, though, a much more capable interceptor that could intercept intercontinental ballistic missiles coming from Iran to the United States. So, and basically, I think what the Defense Department has concluded, that there's probably a more efficient way to defend against the United, to protect the United States. So this plan doesn't affect the ability of missile interceptors to defend Europe. What we've done is we've canceled phase four as we looked for a more efficient way to defend the United States.
But does the cancellation of phase four, does that amount to some kind of olive branch to the Russians or anyone else?
Well, it's interesting. When you talk to people in the government, they say the cancellation was driven by technical questions about phase four and budget questions. They say Russia was not a consideration. But it has to have occurred to somebody in the government on the U.S. side that if we cancel this, which the Russians have been complaining about for 3 years, that has to have some kind of a positive impact on Moscow.
You referred to Iran just a second ago. We've got to talk about Iran. We've got to talk about North Korea. Sure. What about the threats that they pose, and how does that figure into this?
Yeah. Well, a part of the decision that was announced on Friday will be to deploy additional interceptors in Alaska, which will give the United States some measure of protection against North Korea. Now, one of the things the Defense Department said they're going to do is they're going to test and prove the technology before they actually deploy new interceptors, which is a good step. Because I think some of the interceptors that were deployed in Alaska were actually put into the field before they'd been fully tested. So there's some questions, how capable are these things? But that gives us some measure of protection against North Korea. Now, remember, North Korea, they've had one successful satellite launch. They're still probably a number of years from having a missile that could reliably reach the United States. And I think Iran is further behind. So the missile defense conversation in the United States has been...
Is further behind?
Yeah. It'll take Iran longer to get a missile that could reach the United States than it will take North Korea. So.
Okay. But that's geography, right?
Geography, right? Yeah. Iran now can fly missiles maybe to 2,000 kilometers, but they need to get 5,000 miles to get to the United States. And that's just a longer way down the road. And the debate about missile defense, or what the U.S. government is trying to do, is basically stay ahead of that, is have missile defenses deployed before North Korea and Iran would get missiles that could reach the United States. And so far, I think that's a race that the U.S. probably can do fairly well in, if they get the missile defenses to work.
If reducing the overall nuclear threat is priority number one, if we assume that that is the goal, what needs to happen here in the short-term future?
Well, I think the biggest thing that the United States could do is working with Russia is to reduce our stockpiles. Because while the United States and Russia each have about 5,000 nuclear weapons, the nearest third power is France with only 300. And it's very hard, I think, for the United States and Russia to go to third countries and say, don't build up. Yeah. Or go to a country like Iran and say, don't acquire nuclear weapons when we have such a large inventory ourselves. Now, if we are reducing our arsenals, I think that probably is not going to affect directly a change of mind in North Korea or Iran. But what it does do is it gives us greater credibility with other countries to apply pressure on North Korea and Iran. So I don't think it's a coincidence that in the last 3 years, when we've had the New START Treaty, the United States has had more success in persuading other countries to crank up economic and financial sanctions on Iran.
What's the acceptable level? I mean, you threw out this 4,700 number most recently here. What number makes most sense in your view?
Well, I think the next step in a U.S.-Russian negotiation only would be to try to get all nuclear weapons and come down to about 2,000, maybe total weapons. I think it would be hard to get the Russians to go much below that without bringing in third countries, which I would say for the next step, because once you bring in third countries, your negotiation becomes much more complex.
Okay.
Ultimately, I'm a member of Global Zero. I think if we could reach a world where we could be confident that there were no nuclear weapons, which would require huge verification measures beyond what we have now, an enforcement mechanism, I think from an American perspective, that world has some attraction. We have friendly neighbors in Canada and New Mexico. The protection afforded by the Pacific and the Atlantic Oceans and very powerful conventional forces. So, and that would avoid the risks that I think are growing of use of nuclear weapons as more countries acquire them. But that's a long way down the road, and a lot has to happen to get there.
That was Steve Pfeiffer, former ambassador to the Ukraine and director of the Brookings Arms Control Initiative at the Washington, D.C. think tank. The Michigan seal reads, "If you seek a pleasant peninsula, look about you." Well, it's in Latin, so it doesn't say that exactly, but travelers from outside the state are figuring out what Michiganders have known for years. Michigan is a destination. Last year, the state saw an increase in tourism spending, most of which can be attributed to travelers from other states. This week at the annual Pure Michigan Governors Conference on Tourism, MSU professor and tourism expert Sarah Nichols predicted another year of industry growth. Nichols joins current state's Emmanuel Berry to unveil why Michigan's tourism industry is growing.
What we saw last year was a 6% increase in tourism spending, and the measure that we use for spending is how much money is collected by the state as far as collections from hotels and motels. So that's the 6% spending figure that we use. We also saw, however, increases at a lot of our attractions around the state. So as one, a record example, the Henry Ford in Dearborn saw a 25% increase in visitation last year. They had 1.9 million visitors. A lot of that was to do with the Titanic exhibition, which is obviously a temporary exhibition. But they also have a new Driving in America exhibition. So that was a big year. Our national parks also did phenomenally well. The Sleeping Bear Dunes saw a 15% increase in visitation. We think a lot of that has to do with the previous voting of Sleeping Bear Dunes as the most beautiful place in America.
Which it is.
which I will agree it is. But also Pictured Rocks and Isle Royale saw 6 and 5% increases in visitation. And just to give you context, the increase across the United States as a whole, so at all 400 sites, was just 1%.
So what are, you said there was an increase this past year in 2012. What are the projections for how it's all going to turn out next year in regards to spending on tourism in the state?
So what we're projecting is another good, solid year for travel in Michigan. So we think that we'll see about a 3% increase in volume and a 5 to 6% increase in spending, which would be sort of a similar percentage increase as last year. So a couple of unknowns or unpredictables are always, of course, the weather. Mm-hmm. And last year we had a lovely hot, dry summer, which was great for our summer tourism. And we can't control that. Gas prices are always an issue, and gas prices actually were relatively stable last year. They only, in inverted commas, went up 4% last year. And just for context, the year before they went up 26%. So if gas prices can stay in the range that they've been in recently, sort of the 350 to 390, we think that at this point that's an acceptable amount for the average traveler to pay at the pump. The other issue that we don't know quite how will impact travel would, of course, be the sequester and the extent to which that will impact the delivery of services, for example, at our national parks, if there are cutbacks in maintenance and services, and also at our border crossings. So, if there are fewer immigration officers available and that increases the wait time, obviously that doesn't make travelers typically very happy to have to wait longer to come across a bridge or through a tunnel or through an airport to get into the state. But overall, the industry hit a a tough spot back in 08, 09. It's recovering. It's recovered really strongly for several years in a row now. And with continued Pure Michigan, we really think that the industry is really on a very positive trajectory.
Why are people... Why Michigan? What is it about Michigan that's bringing people here and making them more willing to spend their money, say, than, you know, 4 or 5 years ago? Well, what is it about this state right now?
I think the vast majority of this is all to do with the Pure Michigan campaign. So this was a campaign that was initiated in 2006 and it went national in 2009. So that was the first year that Michigan was advertised nationally as a tourism destination. And visitation has increased every year since then. So, you know, typically we find that people outside of Michigan either don't have much of an image of Michigan at all, or it tends to be somewhat tainted by the perception or misperception, depending on how you see it, of Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
What the Pure Michigan campaign is doing is making more people aware of the state, and in particular the phenomenal resources, and obviously the Great Lakes coastline is one of those, but more aware, but also more willing to give Michigan a chance as a destination.
So are these people who are coming, are they coming from all over the state? Is it in-state tourism that's accounting for this somewhat? Where are these people coming from that are creating this increase?
The majority of travelers within Michigan are still people coming from within Michigan, but that's a pretty flat number. The increases are in people coming from outside of the state. And in particular, we're seeing more people from the southern states as well as the East Coast. So there was a news article recently talking about people coming in from the New York and sort of Traverse City area becoming the New Hamptons. We're also seeing more people coming from the southern states, you know, Texas and Georgia, where in the summer it's incredibly hot and humid and not very nice to be outside. I lived in Texas for 5 years. So for people there to come to Michigan and have an 85 degree day is the perfect day. And so obviously, especially for our outdoor activities, hiking and biking and boating and fishing, and of course golfing, 85 degrees is a perfect day to be outside, and we have a fabulous resource, natural resource base to spend that time outside.
So for once, Michigan weather is not bringing us down.
No, it's for summer, and especially, you know, if you believe in climate change, our climate will only become even more attractive as the southern states become even more hot and more humid than they already are.
Now, your report also mentioned some of the trends that are drawing people in general in tourism, but some things that in particular that Michigan has. So one of them is food and beverages. How is Michigan attracting the foodies?
Based around our foods and our beverages is a really rapidly growing niche right now. So more and more people are interested in food in general. They're more interested in where their food came from and learning more about where their food came from. And they're keener to eat local foods and drink local drinks. And obviously with the second most agriculturally diverse state in the country after California, so we have a phenomenal selection of fruits and vegetables and other foodstuffs. We also have really growing and fantastic wine and beer industries in this state. And I think those are two of the really hot areas that we're seeing, not just local and regional recognition, but national recognition as wine and beer destinations. So as one example, Traverse City was named one of the three emerging beer towns for 2012 by Draft Magazine last year. And so, Grand Rapids was tied for Beer City USA last year.
Now, you're also the leader of the 2012 through 2017 Michigan Tourism Strategic Plan. Where do you see Michigan's tourism industry going in the next 4 years? What's the future of tourism in Michigan?
Well, we spent the last year developing this second five-year strategic plan. And the vision is for Michigan to become one of America's favorite Four Seasons travel experiences. So there again, the emphasis on the Four Season experience. And within that plan, we have 8 goals. And underneath each of the goals, between 2 and 6 different objectives. So we have lots of objectives that we've set for ourselves. One of the goals relates to promotion and marketing and communication. So expanding the reach of the Pure Michigan campaign. And
so global, essentially?
Well, so currently, the last couple of years, we've received, the industry has received about $25 million to market itself. The governor has proposed an additional $4 million for the next fiscal year. And if that's received, it would be used primarily in the international market. And there are sort of three key areas. One would be Toronto. So we currently market in Ontario, but we don't market in Toronto. And that's obviously a big and wealthy market.
Mm-hmm.
The second area would be more marketing in the UK, which is probably where you can tell where I'm from, but also the German-speaking countries. And then the third, and what would be a new area for us, would be Asia, and in particular South Korea and Japan and, of course, China, which is the booming tourism market as far as outbound international travelers.
There's a lot of international students here at MSU, mm-hmm. and they're always the thing they talk about is how beautiful it is here and how, you know, the lakes, and that they have this opportunity to experience a very different environment from maybe what they grew up in with Asia. So I can see that potentially being a big draw for the state.
And absolutely. And the international students that we have here is actually a market that we've talked about during the plan, in that, you know, we have more and more international students, and obviously they all have friends and relatives back home. And one of the things we've talked about is some kind of an ambassador program where we can really more actively encourage these students to encourage all of their friends and relatives to come visit them and explore the state and obviously have a fantastic experience and go back home and tell more and more people how worthwhile it is to come to Michigan and spend some time here and enjoying our beautiful state.
Sarah Nichols is an MSU professor and tourism expert. She's also the leader of the Michigan Tourism Strategic Plan. Coming up on tomorrow's Current State, we look at how Michigan farmers are coping with the shortage of migrant workers. And our Knight Center for Environmental Journalism segment looks at the latest report card for the Great Lakes Health. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks also to producer Emmanuel Berry, and thanks to Aaron Young for engineering. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.